Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in. Hope you've had a great day so far. Well, maybe you've heard phrases like this before. Are you ready? God's going to take your mess and turn it into a message, or He's going to take your test and turn it into a testimony. Well, you know, someone called those cliches, while others would say, no, those words and phrases are from the very heart of God. And by the way, what it may be a cliche to one is a lifeline to another. So we need to be a little careful about writing certain things off, because God is in the business of miracles. He's in the business of turning lives around and giving people testimony, using people in life-changing ways. In fact, my guests today have such stories, and I'm telling you, you are in for, an hour. I hope you can stay tuned for the whole hour, because I think it's going to be life-changing. Dr. Thomas Blee, who's joined me before, and I told him before the show, last time he was in, I want to say it was a couple months ago, we received more requests for his book, I think, than any other guest. I think we received like 100 requests for his book. We had 10 to give away. Well, he's so generous, he brought 10 more copies in today. He's also come with his good friend, John Turnipseed, who's also got a book titled Bloodline, You Spend Enough Time in Hell, You Get the Feeling You Belong. Their stories intermingle. Boy, how God brought these two together, a doctor and a former pimp and gang lord. And God has brought them together and is using them in the most profound ways. In fact, I don't want to waste another minute. Let me tell you about him, and we'll get him on the show. Dr. Thomas Blee is a proud father of two sons, Nick and Jack. He was born and raised in Rochester, Minnesota, to a son of a businessman and a tavern owner. He completed med school at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and general surgery residency at Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center in Wisconsin. For 12 years, he practiced general surgery in the small community setting of Red Wing, Minnesota. In 2014, he transitioned his practice to inner city trauma in St. Paul, Minnesota. John Turnipseed's a former gang leader, pimp, and drug dealer, who spent his childhood battling demons brought on by a volatile, abusive father. In a 20-year journey, John Turnipseed has transformed into a community leader, pastor, speaker, and serves as a director of the Center for Fathering, and he's also vice president of Urban Ventures, a 21-year-old nonprofit set in the heart of the same Minneapolis gang territory that John and his family terrorized. Isn't that amazing? John's life-changing turnaround fueled his passion for rebuilding relationships between fathers and their families. John and the Center for Fathering team have now developed programs that reach over 600 men and 200 women every single year. Dr. Tom and John, you can answer at the same time. This will be the only time I ask you to do that, but welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, wow, wow. I'm so honored to have you. In fact, Dr. Tom, when you were on the show last time, I mean, we were crying. I mean, it was so riveting and such an amazing interview. And I kept telling you during the break, you have to come back with John. You have to come back with John. And here you are back with John. So you really are an overachiever. I'm just saying.
Well, I appreciate it. It was a gift. It was really, really neat.
Well, it's such an honor to have you back and such an honor to have John here as well. Let's start, as we always do, with scripture. And either if you have a life verse or just a verse you've been thinking about these days, Dr. Tom, we'll start with you.
Right. I go right back to where I was, Matthew chapter 14. And the joke is sometimes you need more than a verse. You need a whole chapter. Mm-hmm. And that's where I anchor. And for me, as we talked last time, it's the story of getting to know Jesus and watching who Jesus was and all these miracles, but the good friends that surrounded him and the relationship that developed. And the striking part for my life in that chapter is when his friends are in the boat in complete chaos, complete turmoil. And Jesus walks across the water to rescue them. Again, something impossible. And when Peter sees it's Jesus and calls out his name, and Jesus says, I'm here, come get me. And Peter walks on water. But focusing on Christ, he's fine. The minute he turns and doubts and thinks he can't do it, he sinks. And Jesus walks up and just grabs him and just says, I got you.
Hmm. Yeah, that says so much, doesn't it?
Yeah. 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 It's just, yeah, he's there.
He's there. Totally there.
And just cry out.
Mm, indeed, indeed. And for those of you who missed our first conversation, I'm going to, in a minute here, have Dr. Tom just give a little bit of his backstory so you understand the context of how John's and Tom's lives intersect. But how about you, John? What verse do you have on your heart today that you can share?
Well, for a long time in my life, I felt that I had did such awful things that God would never, ever forgive me. Mm. And one day, John 3:16 came into my heart, and, you know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever, even Johnny Turnipseed, believeth in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. It saved my life.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that Jesus saved you. I mean, you look at the ripple effect of your life now. Absolutely amazing. Wow. And we kind of joke in studio because the doctor's wearing this cool plaid shirt and the former gang guy's wearing this really awesome suit. But I shouldn't talk because I'm a little cash myself today. So let's get a little backstory, if we can, Dr. Tom, on your story. And even just if you could weave in where John comes in, because, you know, in your book, absolutely amazing book, How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing, you really start out by saying you kind of had it all. I mean, you really were very successful as a physician, but your world was imploding. Take us to that place.
Yeah. Growing up, I grew up in alcoholism, chaotic home, nasty. And again, I wouldn't trade it for the world because it brought me to where I am now. And moving out of alcoholism, being a child that was, for the most part, had to just sequester myself, stay out of the chaos, read and whatnot. And I picked a career that I thought was untouchable, that nobody could question because there were no doctors or medicine professionals in my family. So pick something really hard and go at it, you know, only in a way that you learn because I survived the alcoholism. I went into small town medicine for various reasons, but got to the point in my career where I just wanted to make a change. I had kind of leveled out. I wanted to teach, and ended up in St. Paul, Minnesota in trauma and acute care surgery. And I was way over my head. It was so different. It was different patients. It was different cultures. It was different surgical techniques. It was difficult to teach. And I thought it was way over my head. And there was also things going on in my personal life that were way over my head. There was a marriage that was failing. And there was a point where I had to just sit down and say, I can't do this anymore. And that's the point where I was on my knees, as I describe in my book, and getting some advice from my sister to get to know Jesus. I reached out to Jesus, gave him a couple of minutes, as only surgeons do, and said, you got to
so
fix
good of
this
you.
One. Right.
Yeah.
And he did. Mm. He reached down and grabbed me.
He did.
And put a series of events in my life. But what happened in the hospital was he was validating me through certain surgical cases. There's things I don't even speak about in the book that are probably more amazing than the stories we use. But a year after I got into my practice, I was faced with something that was completely foreign to me, completely impossible to me, and it was inner city youth violence. It was a situation where in a small town, there wasn't much I couldn't handle surgically, and families were all like me. But we had an episode in the hospital where we had two victims of shootings, young kids, and they ended up next to each other in the hallway, which is unusual. And the kids don't say much, but the noise and the racket and everything that follows them, the dysfunction, shut down the hallway in my hospital. And a nurse came up to me and just said, you need to go fix this. And I said, why me? And she said, you're standing here. And that's when I walked down the hallway and tried to approach these families and absolutely got nowhere, nowhere. I left knowing something was supposed to happen here, knowing I was pushed there. And I spoke to my sister Amy and said, something's happening. What do I do? And it was a couple of days later, she called and said, you know, there's a man I heard on the radio, and I believe it was this station.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you need to listen to his story. And it was probably 12:30 at night, 1 in the morning, is when I listened to the replay about John Turnipseed and everything he had gone through and everything he was at. And I thought, I need that man in my hospital. I was able to get to him by the company, Firestone Media, that was writing his book. Steve Johnson was the gentleman. I found Steve's email, emailed him and said, listen, I've got a problem in my hospital. I've got these kids that shoot each other. They're planning retaliations, all this dysfunction. And I don't know what to do with it. And do you think John could help? The next morning, Steve said, yep, talk to John. He's all in. Why don't you guys meet for lunch? And that's when I drove into Minneapolis and met John for lunch, told him this very same story. And that was the birth of our program, Life Teams. And the concept was we have services for end of life in hospice, in palliative care. But what do we do for brand new life? What can we do differently to take these kids, these families, and just do something different? We can fix them up, we can patch them up, but how do you take it the next step into true healing? And that's the program that we started working on, and almost on the edge of your former gang territory.
Mm, yeah,
is where we met.
Let's pause here because I don't even want to interrupt. I know I'm going to be holding my breath when John Turnipseed gives his story. So let's take an early break here. When we come back, you're going to hear John's backstory, where what childhood was like for you, John, and what teen years was like were like for you, and how you found Jesus, and then how your lives intersected all the more. And what God is doing through these two men is absolutely amazing. They came armed with 10 copies each of their books. So John Turnipseed's book is Bloodline. Dr. Tom's book is How to Save a Surgeon. So chances are really great that you're going to win a copy. So email Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget your mailing address, and we will be back in a minute. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. I'm so excited about today's show. I've got in-studio guests John Turnipseed and Dr. Thomas Blee. And I had Dr. Tom on a couple months ago, and it really was, to me, one of the most riveting shows we've had. And he came with 10 copies of his book then, and I think we received about 100 requests. So I even gave my copy away. Do you believe that? Well, they came back with 10 copies of Dr. Tom's book, How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. You won't be able to put this book down. John Turnipseed's book, Bloodline, You Spend Enough Time in Hell, You Get the Feeling You Belong. We heard a little bit of backstory from Dr. Tom before the break. Now it's time to hear from John Turnipseed. And I want you to take whatever kind of time you need, sir, because I just want to honor your story. Tell us about your childhood. Tell us whatever it is you want to tell us about your backstory.
Okay, I was born in Selma, Alabama, and to a wonderful, wonderful family. Where we lived, there was a grandmother on both sides of me and my grandfather's. And my mother and father, everybody was married. I think there was 18 in my mother's family and 13 in my dad's family, and just a huge family, and loved God and everything God stood for. And I was just this kid with a father who was a deacon in the choir. And, man, I was going to be a preacher when I grew up because life was so good. Well, my father left to come up north here, to start a different life, because around that time, this is 1960, Martin Luther King, you know, everything that was happening down there was really scary. And we came a year later, and that man was not there. He was different. He went from being my hero to the boogeyman. He went from going to church to having multiple girlfriends, and most importantly, to the devastation of my life, he would beat my mother every night. Wow. For no reason except he had alcohol in him. And so we got five little brothers, and I was the oldest, about 7.5 years old. And every night trying to nail the windows shut and putting chairs behind the doors, and he would still break the door down and come in. And we had no phone and no neighbors, and even the neighbors, we did have neighbors, but they never, they wouldn't come to help. And we had to endure that every single night. So I went from being this church boy who was really a good kid. I really was. I know, you know, I was a little bitty guy, loved my little brothers, loved God at the time. And I started hating God because I started praying every day and for the boogeyman not to come. And he came anyways. Mm. So then I start sort of almost devil worshiping. You know, it's like if God can't stop him, maybe we'll kill him. Me and my little brothers were talking about murder at 7, 8 years old, and we'd have little meetings. We didn't know what else to do, and we couldn't tell anybody, and no other family. So that was my existence for a while, and my father just completely ignored us. He didn't live with us. He just came home every night to beat my mother. That's what he did. And because he was gone, you know, you sort of, as a kid, my mother would be sick every morning. I sort of wandered out into the world, and the first person I discovered was a pedophile who, for at that time, you could get 8 White Castle hamburgers for $1, and he would give me $1 every Saturday. And that was a devastating point in my life. Nope. So then this kid started morphing into, it took about a year. And I started, ran into a group of pimps, and I ran errands for them, and I got a knife, and since I ran errands, I didn't have to do the hamburger thing anymore. But it changed me. I was probably the kid you didn't want your kids around. I was. So furthering on, you know, I just kept growing in that life. And finally I got a gun and I started doing armed robberies, feeding my brothers. And I still hadn't had the nerve to kill my father. And I knew when I confronted him, I would. And it wasn't until I was 14, went away to Red Wing State Reformatory for a year. Year and a half, I can't remember. I'd been locked up two or three times from everything from attempted murder to manslaughter to, you know, you name it. I was a different kid. And now when I got out of Red Wing, I got out with, I was going to kill my father. And I didn't care what happened. So tricked him into a parking lot, put a gun to his head and gave him a ultimatum that if he ever hit my mother again, I'd blow his brains out. And he knew I would. And my father carried a pistol. So that was, a very tense moment in my life. And I wished he, at that time, would have pulled his gun so I could get it over with, get the devil out of my life or the boogeyman. Anyways, he left. He left my mother alone. And I went on this path of just very destructive things. By the time I was 16, I had my first child, and an assassin almost killed me and my girlfriend and my child, trying to kill me. And I'd been stabbed, shot other people and things of that nature, just doing everything I had a very ugly life. And God had nothing to do with my life anymore. I just wrote him off completely. I said it took me to get my father from hitting my mother. And what would God, you know, I didn't even like him. So, and that went on. I was in every juvenile institution. Then I started going to prison. And then my family started coming up here. And we have a very large family and very close. A turnip seed is a turnip seed, you know. There's a lot of kids with different names because people stop marrying. My whole family seemed to leave the church. They seemed to follow that model. It seems like a spirit was implanted in our family. And before you know it, we started and maintained the largest gang in Minnesota. And it took the National Guard to actually break us up. So that was, I think we were called Murderapolis and 92, 93, yeah. The New York Times coined a phrase for us because they hadn't seen such a spike of murder. But that was when my family was at its most robust anti-spiritual nature, and we were raising criminals. We were not. We raised criminals. That's what we did. You know, school, all that stuff didn't matter. Women didn't matter. You know, anything to make money, we didn't care. And so nothing was off limits anymore, and nobody went to church. And so that was my life until 24 years ago when I encountered, at the same time that I was doing all this, there was an organization working in that neighborhood that I stayed away from, but my mother really liked them because they were Christians and they always wanted to help. So even when I went to jail, they would help my mother. Hmm. And she just loved them. And she'd always used to tell me, don't you ever mess with those God boys. Meaning that, you know, us and our drug dealing and our violence and stuff, God boys were off limits and stuff. So we had to.
How did that impact you when she said that to you? She's your mother, after all.
It's my mom. So I'm like, God, okay. Well, they, you know, they're bad for business, but they don't mess with us necessarily. And but I sort of knew them, and I didn't, but I never spoke to them. They would leave me alone. And one of the guys told me one time, if you change, he hollered it, you know, standing on street corner, Johnny, if you change, your whole family will change. And I said some really things that we're not going to repeat on the radio. And that was, you know, it. But I thought about that. I'm like, wow, well, I'm not going to change. and stuff. So I was fine. And I, you know, I kept living my life, and things would happen. I had a 3-year-old son who was beat to death by another pimp who stole my first wife. And I mean, that was part of, it was sort of like normal stuff to me, you know. He beat my son to death because my son got in the way of business, you know. So, you know, one of my sons was shot, first time he was shot 13 times, you know. He was following in the lines of me. And there's 4 generations. My father was shot in the head, shot in the arm, and went to prison for a year and deserted his kids. I was shot, went to prison for 10 years, 10 adult years, and abandoned all my kids. My son, Lil Johnny, was shot 13 times, went to prison for 15 years and abandoned his kids. And then my grandson was shot and got life without the possibility of parole. I mean, so every generation, it just got worse. And that was, I believe, a generational curse that was on my family. And I had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. Well, 25 years ago, God saved me. You know, I call him the gangster. I've never experienced anything like that in my life, a spiritual force that powerful, that was humbling. And I just, I can't explain it. You know, when he let me know that I was his and that he wanted me. Mm. And that's been it.
Wow. I want to know about that moment. Mm-hmm. Where were you? Were you in prison? We have a take a break here now, but I want to know what led up to that moment. I want you to give us a little more context of what happened and then what life was like after that, and even the ripple effect on your family. Wow. I told you, am I the only one who's speechless right now? Man, talking to John Turnipseed, Dr. Thomas Blee, and wow, what a mighty pair these two guys are, and really the most unlikely of friends, but you can tell they're the dearest of friends, and God really rescued them from their own hard, heartbreaking story, saved them, put a new song in their mouth, brought them together, and now he's using them to transform multiple cities. It's just absolutely amazing. Okay, so we've got 10 copies of Dr. Tom's book, How to Save a Surgeon, 10 copies of John Turnipseed's book, Bloodline. We're going to put these together. So if you win, you get both books. So email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget the mailing address. If you've got a question, include that as well. I'll do my best to weave it into the rest of our conversation. More riveting conversation in just a moment. Hope you're having a great day. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. Wow, I'm so glad you tuned in. If you just tuned in, this is one you got to go back and catch the whole show from the top. I've got Dr. Thomas Blee and John Turnipseed in studio, and their stories are riveting and absolutely amazing. And John, we're still kind of in the middle of your story. So before the break, you're talking about how when you were young, you were raised in a giant Christian family. I mean, you had a wonderful life. And then your dad moves to the Twin Cities here from Alabama, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And when you all caught up with him, he was a different man. He started to cheat on your mom. He'd come home here. You're 7 years old at this point. Your dad went from being your hero to being the villain in your family. He would beat your mom every single night. And, oh, my goodness, so much trouble that it brought into your home. And you ended up being angry, of course, and had a wretched, horrible time. Became a gang leader. Lots of your family ended up moving. And you just said it was like the enemy just dropped a bomb in your family because one by one, people walked away from the faith to the point where in the Twin Cities, the Turnipseeds were the largest gang in this Twin City area. And you were in and out of jail. You have 4 generations in and out of jail. And you get to a point, though, in your story where you say God met you and it was a powerful force. I want to know, did you have any sense leading up to that moment when the Lord connected with you that your heart was softening or did he just ambush you? I mean, how did this happen?
It actually was an ambush.
All right.
Right at that time. You remember the God boys I was talking about?
Yeah,
the ministry. You know, they had a ministry. They started a thing called the Center for Fathering. And a friend of mine, they hired him. He was an ex-con. He said, Johnny, man, you got to come here, man. This is something really good. So being him, just to be a friend, he was in prison with me. I'll come to your group, man. You know, whatever, I'll help you out. And I came there, and I was the first client for the Center for Fathering. And they immediately started talking to me about stuff, about my life. I was addicted to drugs. I was in and out of prison and I was in a criminal enterprise right then. They didn't know it, but I was still doing a lot of I had groups from all different states, about five different states that were working with us on this one criminal enterprise. So anyways, making a lot of money, and I just wanted to be a dad. I don't know why, but and right around that time, my son got shot. He got shot 13 times, shot his right leg off. When the assassins came, they knew they had to kill him because, we retaliated hard, but he lived. But I was going through that, and I got arrested. And so I got arrested, and I was working, because I was on parole, so I had to have a job. And I was working as a teacher, and Tom Lydon of Channel 9 News, came to my job with full cameras and told my students who I was. They did not know that I was who I was. Nobody knew that I had all those felonies. Nobody knew my past life, and I always wore suits, so they thought I was this nice teacher guy. And I went into my office, and for the first time in my adult life, I was ashamed. Because my students, they were adult students, but they were, "Mr. Turnipsey, what do you do?" And I went in my office, and I just started crying. And I didn't have my gun or anything, so I would have blown my brains out. But I didn't know what to do, and I couldn't kill myself. And I told God right then, "If you are really God, you have to come right now. If you don't come, I don't know what I'm going to do." And he came. I barricaded myself in my office. He just told me to get up off the floor. "You're my son. I got you." Wow. And I got off the floor and I dusted my suit off and I unbarricaded the door and I walked out smiling. People were wondering what's wrong with me. I'm saying, "No, I'm all right." And I knew I was. And I had just been indicted for at least 50 felonies. I ended up pleading guilty to 50 felonies, and I was going to go to prison for a very long time, and something happened. This Urban Ventures group of people got rallied behind
me.
The God Boys. Mm-hmm. Ex-Governor Al Quie. They just came out of the woodworks and stood up for me in court, and the judge gave me probation, a career felon. I was a three-time loser. I was almost supposed to get at least 40 years, if not more. And these men stood up for me, and I'd been coming to the group for a year, and I wasn't walking around telling everybody about my conversion. It was me and my private thing, and the judge gave me probation. I didn't deserve it. I didn't deserve the men standing up for me. That's God. That's how he gets down. That's who he is. That's why I call him the gangster, because he bends. When he decides that he wants something done, nobody can stand in his way and stuff. So he could take this thing I was and make men rally around me. Wow, I'd never even been hugged by a man.
When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, even his enemies are at peace with them. Your way is pleasing when you're right with him. And you'd gotten right with him and nobody else knew it. And yet somehow, even your enemies were at peace with you at that moment.
The judge sensed it.
That's amazing.
He seen something that he had seen me a number of times. So, I'd been in the system all my life, but he's seen something different in me.
Wow.
And so.
So tell me how this played out then with your family. And even the people who were counting on you, you were actually a significant leader in this criminal enterprise. What changed after that?
Everybody thought it was a game that I was playing for court. "Oh, yeah, Johnny, okay. They've seen this before. They've seen many guys, you get in trouble, you act like you're doing the God thing and stuff, and you try to get some leniency," but mine was real. And I created some enemies. People were very angry at me. A couple of my grandsons wouldn't speak to me. My son stopped talking to me, who adored me. In my family, I was now a traitor. I led people down a path, and all of a sudden, I'm going to get off the path, it was and I had a lot of enemies out there, and without the protection of my family anymore.
Wow.
I was at risk for a while and stuff.
And how did God meet you in that place?
God just, it just came to a point where I was no longer afraid. Mm-hmm. I was no longer afraid. People that had shot at me shot me. This people that I'd shot, you know, would see me and just say hi. You know, I didn't have to run and hide from people. I can't explain it. They just wilted away, mm-hmm. you know.
And then all these, so it's been 24, 25 years now.
Yes.
What's happened in your family since then?
My family went from 80% in the family enterprise, criminal enterprise, to 80% in church now.
Wow.
We have probably about 10 ministers in my family that used to be gangbangers. We have children graduating from high school and going to college, which we used to, all of our kids used to drop out when they were 12, 13 years old, because you didn't need school for what? You know, you're going to be a criminal. Now we got kids graduating. The family gang has dissipated to maybe there's a little group of 10 of them that sort of hang around together. But they no longer are a threat in the city. You don't hear anything about them. And we're in church. We're in church. So God talk has replaced the gang talk. You know, we actually, as a family, talk about Jesus. You know, my grandkids, all of them know Jesus. They know who he is, and they know what Grandpa expects of them.
Wow.
In life.
Is your mom still alive?
My mother passed. And stuff.
Did she live to see you turn around?
Yes, she did.
Come on.
She was so proud of me.
I'm sure.
Stuff. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
You know.
So tell our friends what you're doing now. I said it in your bio, but I want them to know.
Well, right now I'm the executive vice president of Urban Ventures Foundation. We are an organization that helps families. I work very closely with the Center for Fathering. I work with first-time offenders. The mayor's office appointed me as the ambassador for my brother's keeper from the White House, from the Obama initiative. The sheriff of Minnesota and the chief of police are actually friends of mine, you know.
He looks a little surprised as he shares that.
They're actually, they're on a first-name basis. I got their cell phone numbers. The sheriff endorsed my book, actually.
Wow.
Because they know my change is real.
That's right.
And I'm working to help people get away from that lifestyle. I don't believe in gangs. Gangs are the most destructive thing. I'm not afraid to say that. Gangs are just eating the lifeblood of my community.
It's a cancer. It really is.
It's absolutely.
So, Dr. Tom, we've got our last break here in a few minutes. But so back to you opening the show, talking about here you're the surgeon and you're newly converted, really, because you came to your own crisis point where you needed Jesus and he also ambushed you, showed up, and the change was real. Around that same time, you're an inner city trauma surgeon and you're in the middle of gang activity, basically out in the hallway. And you're like, something's got to change. You call your sister who heard John's story on this network. And somehow, some way, because you're a guy who gets things done, you end up having lunch with this man. You guys become friends. How did bringing him into the hospital change things? What did you do and what did he do?
There's two things, I think, because I, you know, what I thought I needed, I didn't know, but what he knew, what I needed, Jesus, and so on. And so there was a professional issue because I didn't know how to deal with a significant portion of my patient population. But I was so broken, I was so wounded, I was so lost that I needed my own mentor. I needed someone to walk this walk with me. And here shows up John. Mm. And he was immediately engaging because when we first met, he says, "Where are you from?" I said, "Red Wing." He says, "Red Wing? I know Red Wing. I graduated high school there." And I'm thinking, there's only one high school. And he's like, "The boys' prison."
We're talking about
and that's how it was.
Wow.
So there was an instant attraction with him, but there was an instant resource. I needed his wisdom into the hospital, and we were able to develop the process and life teams to get him in with me. We began bringing him in as a minister and a preacher, and as we developed the program, he now comes in as a consultant and so on. And so now when you know, you have a young person who has looked death in the eye and wants to change, I can medically get them to a point and then bring in John and other people that we now have working with us and so on and really start healing. Really move it to a different direction.
So you really are. I mean, it is really a different kind of care because mm-hmm. if there is a critical point there where some, when they hit that point, if somebody's there to help them, they may want to take that out. They may, but if there's nobody there, the vacuum would call them right back, right?
To absolutely.
The
light. Absolutely.
Wow.
Guaranteed.
Well, I want to pause here. When we come back, I want to know, you know, love to know, John, have you dealt with intimidation? I can't imagine because you just seem like you that God has done something so strong in you that you can face some of these scary individuals. I'm wondering if you've come into the hospital to face some gangbangers. What went through your head, and what did those conversations look like? And then I want you both to just share the impact of the ministries that you're both involved in right now. Just cast a vision for not only what you're doing, but what you think God wants you to do. We've got 10 copies of John Turnip's Seed's amazing story, which also was made into a movie. It's called Bloodline. You spend enough time in hell, you get the feeling you belong. And then also How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing by Dr. Thomas Blee. Both are riveting. So everybody who wins is going to get both copies, right? So email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget the mailing address. And we will be back in a minute.
Surely my God is the strength of my soul. Your love defends me. Your love defends me.
Great song. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. I'm so honored to have John Turnipseed and Dr. Thomas Blee in studio. They each have a book. They each came armed with a stack of them. So if you win today, you win a copy of each of their books. John's book is Bloodline. You spend enough time in hell, you get the feeling you belong. This story is absolutely amazing, how God took this man who was part of one of the largest family gangs in the Twin Cities to become a pastor and a mentor and a consultant and a man of God. And then there's Dr. Thomas Blee, who's a trauma surgeon, and his book is How to Save a Surgeon, Stories of Impossible Healing. Love to get your name in the drawing. Just email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. And again, if you just tuned in, you got to trust me on this. Go back and catch the podcast. It'll be up after the live show. So, John, we're at this point in your story where you're just talking about how God just ambushed you, and he started to, you know, give you a heart for kids who are where you have been. And I asked you, kind of going out to the break and in the break, do you ever struggle with just intimidation or old fears as you're facing down these kids who are hardened criminals? But you made a point during the break that if you've stared death in the face, you have a window of opportunity. So take it from there and explain what you mean there.
Yeah, I've been shot. You know, my kids have been shot. You know, my son was laying on an operating table, you know, with his leg shot off from a sawed-off shotgun. And so I've seen a lot of this, but I know in that window, in that space, that God is a real reality. These kids will cling on to hope, and that's that window that we, unless you're a doctor, you don't get in that window. And if you can get in there while they are at their most, they just know their life has been saved, there's an amazing opportunity there. You know, you don't have to hold back anything. They know it was God. You know, it's just
amazing.
It's overpowering.
And so insightful for you, Dr. Tom, to know that there, you know, as you're saying, we have, you know, care for those who are being ushered from this life to the next. But for young people in gangs who have that window of time to know that, okay, you've just survived. Some maybe automatically have their mindset on going back, but you see it in their faces sometimes. If there was a way out, I would like to take it. And here you connect with John, because those are the people you want to connect with. I mean, say a word about that and just what you've seen happen as a result.
Yeah, it comes down to hope. Yeah. You know, I was a point in my life where I was so down and I was so worn out that what Jesus gave me was just hope, one flicker of hope. And when you enter the rooms of these patients, and you can feel there's no hope. The window shades are pulled down. The sheets are up to their nose. The patient themselves, they're just beat down and ugly. And when John and I started working together, you know, the first young man, Keontae, that we were working with, it was just a flicker of hope. And we thought you could see everything change. And that's what we say. We went, you know, these kids are surrounded by dope dealers, but now we've got hope dealers.
Love that.
Yeah. And that's, I think, as basic as I can get it. And it's universal. Yes, we work with a lot of kids involved in gangs and touching the system and so on. That's probably 10 or 15% of our work, though. Because if we're in drug abuse, anything that comes to my trauma center, it's drug abuse, it's opioids, it's methamphetamine, it's the last gentleman I've been working with lost his leg in a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. He needs hope for a different part of the life. And I think that's how the team was formed, by God. I needed hope. John came into my life. John was at a point where we needed each other. We truly needed each other to walk through certain parts of our lives. Mm-hmm. And he put us in a situation where were working with these kids, but we would travel and speak, and we would spend hours together, hours traveling and talking and getting to know each other. And
I just love, what a divine connection. I just see how God is so part of this. And John, you said during the break that there was a particular young man that you worked with that would have normally would have wanted to shoot you.
Yeah, he belonged to a different sector of gangs, you know, white. You know, I'm African-American. We both are in prisons. He's rolling with, you know, like motorcycle gang types and skinheads and stuff. And I'm a black racist, you know, fool, basically. And we would have collided big time in our life and stuff. And when he was in a certain predicament, he heard about me. And when I remember walking into his room and I seen the color leave his face. I mean, he was already a little pale, but I seen the color leave his face. And I think he said, "You're a brother." And I said, "Yep, I sure am. Because my name, you can't tell who I am, Johnny Turnipseed." And, but somehow his heart just, he was in such a place where he just needed, he was just facing losing his leg. And my son had lost his leg and stuff. And we just started talking. And I visited that kid probably 25, 30 times. And every time we came, we talked about real things. It was like me and him were brothers, you know. And, you know, me, him, and Dr. Tom watched the Super Bowl together, you know, eating peanut M&Ms that clogged up his tubes.
He's got in trouble
but
for that.
My grandson, I brought my grandson in.
And Jack was there, my son.
This kid migrated. This kid went from this evil, crazed, you know, motorcycle. He just was out there to one of the most gentlest men and caring individuals that I've ever met, you know. And we were like a family. We're buddies, you know, Dr. Tom, I, you know, him, our kids. We brought our kids in because once a man is changed, once God has changed him, he is no longer a danger to kids. And for me, it's been, man, I know a doctor. You know, my friends would ask me, "A doctor?" I'd say, "Yeah, man, what does he look like?" "He's a doctor, you know, he's a doctor. What is he, what do you guys talk about?" "Man, I'm so smart, you know, of course he wants to pick my..." No, but because God, you know, God took this guy with 10 felonies and put him together with the doctor for his purpose. I can't figure. I don't have to figure it out. No. We're a very odd couple, but he's sort of funny though. he tells good jokes. So he always picks on me. So
I love it. So, Dr. Tom, do you have a story? You're a great storyteller. But just as you're thinking about, just tell a story if you would of somebody you guys have helped, somebody that you've encountered in your role as a surgeon, where you've seen God move.
Yeah, too many for my book, but I mean, I'll come right back to who John was talking about, Brad, because Brad is in the book. And Brad was interesting because he was hit by a train. He's from North Dakota. He was trying to get his life turned around. He broke his leg in a four-wheeler accident, had to sell drugs to get out of that, ended up doing 3 years in prison, was back in North Dakota with somebody of the family that was trying to get him moving, and he's hit by a train. Stabilized out there and flown to our trauma center, and I met him in the operating room. I met him because I was called up by our orthopedic surgery team, and he was missing half of his abdomen. He had a colon injury that had broken down. He was literally seeping stool into open pelvic fractures.
Wow.
And we did what we could to put him back together. He went subsequently through 55 operations in our medical institution, skin grafts, all kinds of things, to the point of the orthopedic surgeon saying, "Your leg is non-functional. We're going to cut it off." And I remember distinctly, John and I were in a workroom beginning to work with another young man, and a nurse came in and said, "Oh, my God, they're going to cut Brad's leg off." And John perked up and said, "I should probably meet him. My son went through this." And that's how we got going. Brad made this decision not to get his leg cut off, was discharged from the hospital, and came back a week later with the world's worst infection you can ever have, a drug reaction. He looked like he was put in a microwave. Kidneys had shut down, bone marrow had shut down. He was one where I met him in the operating room, in the emergency room. They called me at 3:30 in the morning and said, "A guy named Brad is here, wants to talk to you." And I went downstairs. I could touch an inch of skin on his palm. And he said, "Tom, you need to kill me right now." And I said, "Brad, I can't do that." He said, "You know me. You know who I am. You can kill me." And I said, "All I can do right now is pray." And I had not prayed with anyone out loud at that point. I prayed. I don't remember what I said. And Brad fell asleep. I left on vacation. We come back. He's moved through the intensive care unit. We got to know him. Subsequent, John was meeting with him. I was meeting with him on call. My son needed to do some volunteer hours, designed a Super Bowl party for Brad up at the hospital. On and on it goes to the point of Brad and I are speaking in October, keynote speaking, the North Dakota State Trauma Conference. We're going to tell Brad's story back in the state where he was injured, because he is now, he's almost fully healthy, has his leg in college.
He has his leg?
Leg, yes. Yeah, that's part of the story, is he never, he worked with us.
He got over the infection and didn't need the amputation.
Infection, the function came back. He considers himself almost 100%. He walks with a little bit of a brace, but he's back.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's one of many stories. I mean, the stories in your book, How to Save a Surgeon, just riveting. We've just got about 2.5 minutes or so. Any other stories you'd love to tell? Just because I think it just inspires such hope, or even vision you want to share of what you want to see God do. I just want to give you the time.
I would tell just real quickly, the young man, I won't say his name, he's in the book, the kid that got shot, and you had told him, there's nothing else I can do, basically. He wasn't absorbing food. He was basically dying and stuff. And that young man and stuff, his mother was mad at you and everything, you know. And we started working with him. And now this kid is out of the hospital. He's working. His father and him have reunited. Just a great kid, you know. But he was in a gang. He left them. I mean, his whole life changed. But he was on his deathbed. He was supposed to die 2 weeks after I met him. I was feeding him Popeye's chicken.
Yeah, against my, he called me. Yeah,
you fed him?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
So whatever John does, you sort of have to undo sometimes, right?
We have a pact. Right. We have a pact. I say, John, don't be a doctor. And he says, well, don't be a gangbanger. There's a quick story that we tell, because John had made a comment. We were speaking in another city that was having some problems with gangs, and John made a comment about Chipotle, the restaurant that had some problems with the E. coli. And John mentioned that they had Ebola going on. And I said, this is being recorded. And I stopped. I said, okay, we're going to, this. It's E. coli. Yeah. But I had a similar situation because I was working with a young man that was involved in the Latin Kings, and I was reading tattoos and things, and I usually don't mention anything, but he was, so I slid in to take this home. I'm like, he's engaging me. Let's talk about it. LK, it's 2 a.m. I'm 24 hours into a shift or something. And I said, how long have you been running with the Lion Kings? And he looked at me, did you just call it the Lion Kings? And I went, oh, John, just keep me on track.
Exactly.
Please.
We need each other. We need each other. Well, this is probably, I don't know, I'm just going to ask if you would both prayerfully consider coming back, because I feel like we're just scratching the surface on what God is doing through the ministries. If they want to know about more of what Life Teams are about, why don't you rattle off a couple websites here for us, for people to check out?
I don't have any. I mean, I do the work, my 503, you know, and the nonprofit's forming and so on, and it's just work that we do. It's work that we speak.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
So, okay, then when we come back, when you guys come back, we have to take our out music here, but when you come back to visit, we're going to just find a way to give them information in case they want to donate to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But Venture, too.
Urban Ventures.
Urban Ventures is a good place.
If they type in my name,
John Turnipseed.
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of stuff.
There's only one John Turnipseed. Well, you've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. I told you it would be amazing. Don't go away. Hour 2 is up next.